Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
I'm your host, Dr. Elise, and I have the immense privilege of sitting down with the brilliant and beautiful Zoe Flowers to discuss the evolution, the revolution of career and purpose through healing art and spiritual work. Zoe Flowers is an advocate, an artist, and healing practitioner. She is a writer and has created poetry and essays that span multiple media. As a researcher, Zoe conducts listening sessions with a wide range of communities, including survivors of violence in diverse communities around the world. As an artist, Zoe creates films, theatrical productions, and books that invite audiences to explore social issues, healing, and spirituality. This year, she launched Come to the Brink with Zoe Flowers, a podcast exploring who we become when the roles we once held no longer define us. Welcome, Zoe.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Before we dive deep into what you do, tell us a little bit about who you are.
That's a great question. Who am I today?
Excellent.
Today I am a traveler, a seeker, a curious being, and an excitable animal.
Yes. Yeah.
a vessel for ancient knowledge and wisdom. A willing participant in the game of life. So many things today.
Yes. My goodness, that all of that sounds so exciting to me. I'm trying to rethink now. Well, who am I today?
A vessel. I like that. A vessel for divine wisdom. I love that. I think that's what I'm going to say from now on.
I think I would add divine wisdom and action.
Yeah, that works too.
Or from my little busy life.
Yeah, I love it. That works.
But I'm trying to move towards some divine pause. So thank you for telling us more about who you really are as a being expressing yourself in this particular life and time and space. Thank you. So tell me, how did you get involved in social justice work?
I got involved. Well, I've always been interested in justice. And from a very early age, I was able to pick up things that were just, as I think most little kids know, like just from unjust things. So one of the things I remember is being in the grocery store at my grandmother's house, which was in the inner city. And I remember the difference in the fruit than we had in the suburbs where I grew up. And I remember asking my mother, why did the fruit look different where we lived versus where my grandmother lived? Which, of course, I got no answer. Of course, I got an answer to that, right? Right. So I just started off very early, stepping into the gaps for classmates that were being bullied, befriending people who were being bullied in school, doing that kind of thing. So, yeah, I've always stood in the gap for justice. And I guess when I started getting paid for it was in a domestic violence relationship, dating violence relationship in my very early 20s. And that ended up in a stalking situation. So I had to leave the state and I moved to Atlanta, Georgia, and was just answering an ad in a newspaper. I had no intentions on doing any type of social justice things for a living. That was not my path. It wasn't on my radar. I knew absolutely nothing about any of that. I just answered an ad for an office manager at the Georgia Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Didn't have any understanding of what domestic violence was by the name, no interest, as I said, at all. I answered an ad in the paper and got the job as an office manager. And that was at a time when we had libraries in our coalitions and in our organizations. And I just started to read everything that was in our library. And then I was like, oh my goodness, wow, there have been people who have been doing this for like over 30 years. There was like a long history of this. And wow, there's a name for the things that I experienced. And there was a whole process of indoctrination that went into lining me up to be a survivor of violence. So that's how I got into it. Very much the human self would say by accident, but of course there's no accidents. But yeah, that wasn't the path I was interested in at all. I was going to be an entertainer.
And I wasn't sure about this question. So, it was kind of like a B question, not an A question.
All right.
But so do you consider yourself still a part of social justice work? And if you do, why do you or why don't you?
I guess. Yeah. I'm still working with organizations that do social justice work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know about, you know me, at least. I don't know about all these titles and all that stuff. I don't know if it's social justice work. I don't know in this current climate what that even means. But I am still doing the work. Yeah, with and in community. I'm still doing domestic violence work. I just entered back into some short-term work with a burgeoning grassroots domestic violence organization in Southern California. So... yeah. And then another organization, an indigenous Mexican organization that works on repatriation. Now, the thing, the ways that I'm working with them are different, not the DV. That's more like what I had been doing in the past. But this other organization, it's mainly healing and wellness work. And we've been working together for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's more like helping them to communicate with each other and giving them healing and wellness practices and doing readings for them. So it's very different, the work that I'm doing with them, but it's a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'm supporting them, I guess you could say, and so maybe it's more healing justice actually than social justice at this point. I think that's more what it is now. Helping them to do their work.
I think social justice, I think, is a mainstream white, patriarchal, progressive white term that I think Black and brown people picked up and used because that's what white folk who were doing so-called progressive work around liberation, freedom, wherever, had already named that type of work. But it seems to me, in like the last 10 years, that Black and Brown people have been redefining what social justice work is. And I think it no longer even fits under that definition, because I feel like, to your point, what we're doing is more about healing, relationship building, community work, restorative work. It's not all that, not to say that this other work is not strategic, but it's not that type of strategic work.
So I just Googled the term, and it was coined by an Italian Jesuit priest, Luigi Taparelli, in the 1840s to describe fair relations within a social organization, particularly in the context of addressing the social problems of the Industrial Revolution.
Mm.
His use of the term in his work, A Theory of Natural Law, sought to establish a moral framework for society to balance individual rights with the common good.
And we see how that went. That's amazing that it started out as an idea to bring equity in organizations, in companies, in the workforce. That's what I was going
to
say.
And to address social disruptions and inequalities caused by the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah.
So that is a very specific, and it's interesting how it's been expanded to address all of these other societal issues.
Yes.
In the 1840s. So again, it's interesting that language has...
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Changed,
yes.
Since the 1880s.
Yeah. And then I think at least I know, as I talk to Black and Brown women, they're using the term less and talking more specific about the work they do rather than couching it in some big term.
Yeah.
And so I think that's somewhat of an evolution and a revolution in and of
itself. Yeah. I agree.
Yeah. But I really want to get to, you know, as you know, I've said over the years, you've always been an inspiration for me. You've always, the way you've lived your life and the way in which you've done your work has always called me to something higher, called me to something more, made me believe in something more and hope for something more, even though I often didn't even know what that something more was. But your life, and again, the way you did your work, said clearly there is something more. This is not it, or this is not all there is.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's something lacking here. And so this is not where you stay or rest. This is just a stepping stone.
Yeah. Made it possible for me to like survive. I had something to, so I was always an artist. I always had an artist sensibility. I always saw things in pictures, in film form, always. That's how I made sense of the world until I found spirituality. Like, and those things were always very close for a long time, like before I had access to the spiritual work or spiritual living that I have now. All I had was the church. So I used to go to church too, which I loved. I loved the singing. I loved the stories, the biblical stuff. Like, I loved the whole shebang bang. And so those things were always super, super present for me. And so when I started doing the work, again, I just answered an ad in a newspaper, right? I'm an office manager. Okay. I'm just here to do office manager shit. And then I'm like, oh my God, again, there was like, there's so much literature. And oh my God, and look at these smart women, like all these brilliant people. And so we used to have, and when I, so let me say this. So I went to the coalition as an office manager, but I was promoted within 6 months because the ED at the time was like, there's something else going on here with you. I think you probably could do more than be an office manager. And I was like, cool. Like, literally went on vacation and came back, and I was the membership and training coordinator. Just went on vacation, came back to a promotion. Fantastic. So because I was the membership and training coordinator, I was responsible for putting on the 40-hour trainings for the advocates. So I had to plan that and get all the resources. And so there used to be this tape that we used to use in our training called the Lisa tape. I don't know if you remember the Lisa tape. There was this little girl, and she was calling 911. And you would hear her mom and dad in the background. He was abusing the mother. And then the police would come, and the father just like flipped the script, like, hey, officer, there's nothing wrong here. And so we used to use that training to, you know, talk about like abuse isn't about anger, and how people who use violence, they can turn it on and off depending on, you know, who was there. And the first time I heard that tape, I had to like leave the room, because all of a sudden I started having nightmares. And I started remembering the things. So this work really brought up things that I had suppressed from a kid. Mm-hmm. Things I just didn't remember. Now, mind you, the reason why I was in Atlanta was because I was being stalked and I had to get the hell out of there, because the police were like, hey, guess what? It's the 90s. We can't help you. Do your best, right? So I was like, fine, I'll move to Atlanta. Didn't know anybody, but I had gone there to do a hair show like 4 months prior. And so I was like, well, I'm just going to move to Atlanta and just like start this new life. So 2 years later, now I'm working at this coalition. And so even though I had experienced dating violence, I had, again, I had no word for it. I thought I just was dating an angry guy, you know, who I was just like trying to love and all of that. So, but that Lisa tape really was just like shocking, and then reading everything and like, oh my God. I mean, back then we used to get those clips. I don't know if you had this in your organization, where we would get the clippings of like all the DV cases and homicides and all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. We would get it like in emails. Mm-hmm. And I was responsible for collecting those clips. So I'm like printing these clips off, cutting them out. Like, talk about old school. We had them like in a photo album. So all of these, just again, these memories were come up. So there was that. And again, I've always been spiritual. I'd always been into woo-woo stuff, meditation. I was into meditation then. I was definitely into crystals then. I was into a lot of stuff, certainly not as much as now, but I definitely was like, whoa, something's happening to me. Mm-hmm. I'm changing. Mm-hmm. My happiness is changing. The way I see the world is changing, and now for the better. And when I look around at all these women that I'm working with, everybody's sick. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are mean. Mm-hmm. And quite a few of them are teetering on the edge. Mm-hmm. And if I'm going to stay in this work, I need to find a way to stay in this work so that I don't become any of those things. Mm-hmm. And that was my second year into the work. So that was 2001. I had that realization. I just was like, why are people dying out of this work?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I was...
We don't get that for a long time. I mean, usually years. We're in the work for years before we realize, oh, this is... The trauma that we're supposed to try to end, trauma and violence, sorry, the violence that we're trying to end and the trauma we're trying to mitigate is all infused in the lives and the systems of the organization I work for. And usually I don't know anyone that it came to them in a year's time.
It didn't take me that long.
You were,
it didn't take me long at all.
Yeah. You were,
it didn't take me long.
You were really open. You were really open.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm very aware, and I would be like, why am I hearing elevated voices in the grocery store and going towards that noise to like make sure people aren't fighting, right? So that hypervigilance and all of those things. And we were just starting to, and Lord knows, so much pushback. We were just starting to talk about vicarious trauma too then, because this is 2001.
Mm-hmm.
So people really, they still didn't want to talk about it, but the Georgia Coalition, I was doing trainings on vicarious trauma. I mean, were we calling it vicarious trauma then? We might have been calling it burnout. I think we might have been calling it burnout. And then by the time I got to California, I think we were calling it vicarious trauma.
Mm-hmm.
So that also, I was like very aware of like, all these people talk about is violence. And I was one of them. I'm like, I'm one of these people. Like we would work all day, go out to dinner and talk about violence all night long. Like that, my whole life was like consumed with violence. And I was like, this is not, I'm gonna have to do something. So I had that thought. I was already going to yoga and things like that, but I still didn't really do the thing, right? I had the thought, okay, I need to do the thing. And I did some things, but it still took me decades to really like get my shit together around that. Two decades.
I remember many years ago when my wife was alive, we lived in North Carolina, and I think we had some friends over just for the, we were building community. So we had friends over because we always did. and just talking. And I don't remember what we were talking about, or this is all I remember is my wife said to the group, to the guest in the house.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The tourist said out loud, I don't care what you're talking about. Elise can connect those dots to violence against women.
Yeah,
I know she meant it as a compliment. I know she meant it as this is Elise's passion and she's thorough in her thinking about it. But what it said to me was, what? That's all that's in my brain? That's all I can talk about? My life is consumed with violence?
Consumed.
Yes, consumed. And I thought, oh, I've got to do something different. I didn't know what. The first thing I started doing was I started reading fiction.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first thing I started doing. I started reading fiction again. And then just started getting involved. And I
want to make a difference in your community, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
I started getting out and getting involved in other things, and fun clubs and stuff like that to get myself in, reintroduced to the rest of life.
Yeah.
But still, like, it still was years before I really saw it face to face and start really doing something concretely to make to make a change in my own life.
I don't think for me it wasn't the violence. For me, it was the community. For me, it was the first time that, first of all, I had been celebrated for anything, for my brain, for what I had to say. It was the first time that people were like, no, we actually, usually people are like, shut the fuck up. Like, that was my life. People are like, we don't want to hear that. We don't want to, well, who cares about the fruit? Like, we don't want to hear that. But now here I am, I'm like 31 or 32, and people are like, no, come speak on a panel. Like, we want to hear what you want to say. And I wanted to hear what people had to say.
Mm-hmm.
And we were working towards something. So it wasn't like, oh, I'm obsessed with the, well, maybe, because then I did watch true crime and horror shit. But I mean, whatever, I'm American. Like, whatever, it's violence. It's violence all day. So, but it was the community. Mm-hmm. It was people. It was like, I am doing something that matters. I am trying to, at that time, I was like we all say, oh, I want to make sure that nobody experience. I should make that voice. It's so disrespectful. So disrespectful. But anywhere. But that, again, maybe that was my voice. Like, I want to make sure that nobody experiences what I experienced, right? That was my thing. Mm-hmm. But then when I moved to California and I was at the California Partnership and we were going through, I like to call it group therapy as a staff, one of our teachers, she said, y'all think you're coming here to heal these people, these women, but what you're really here to do is heal yourself.
Right.
And so it was that too. I was there to heal. Like I just said, like nobody wanted to hear anything I had to say. Right. And so it was healing. It was healing to be in an environment of people that were just as passionate, just as fired up about shit as I was. And it was a small price to pay at that time. Even though it was all my time, it was no vacation. It was, you know, it was no vacation. If I took a vacation, you know, we would tack a day on to a work trip or 2 days after. If we got lucky, maybe three, right? But it was a small price to pay because guess what? All my friends were there too. Like, oh, I was working with my friends. So it was a small price to pay at that time.
Yeah, I think what I did discover very early in the work was that I wasn't doing the work that would move me in the direction or move the work in the direction that I thought was important. The reason I really had come So I felt like I was doing really good work. But for me, it wasn't the work that would really move the needle that I wanted to move. And so absolutely, especially while we're at Women of Color, I know we moved a lot of needles. We did some really great stuff, especially around getting funds to culturally specific programs, the OVW funds. We did some really great work there and bringing diverse cultural groups together to, you know, talk about what they had in common. We did really great work, but I always knew I wasn't doing the work that I had come to do. And I often felt that not we, as in us, but I often felt like a lot of people in the movement just should not be in the movement because they were bringing the thing we were trying to destroy or take down, remove, dethrone. They were bringing that into the work. They were infusing the work with violence and oppression and inequity, all of that. I realized that too soon, because I remained in the work a long, long time with that reality, knowing that was happening, and I'd be honest and say, and couldn't do anything about it. And so often I would think of it from a very spiritual perspective, and I would remind myself, oh, these are people who too have been violated, who live in a society of violence. Women, regardless of color or lack thereof, have been groomed by a culture of violence. And so they are, I used to always say, we're all survivors. There is no absolute survivors. We're all survivors.
I used to say the same thing.
Yeah. And so sometimes I could get there. And I think that's probably what carried me through most of the time. It was still a very heavy burden to carry for all those many years, knowing that truth, that there was so much of the things that we wanted to dethrone, we wanted to remove, dissolve, were the very things that we were bringing into the movement. That was a hard piece for me. And I think that's one of the reasons why you were always inspiring to me, because it seemed like even though you knew that, you didn't live there.
Mm-mm. No, because I did things on the side. When I, the Georgia Coalition, that was my first gig, and it was like, we not really doing community work. It was very clear. It was like, that's not our role. So then I was like, oh, okay, well, then I'm going to just go and I'll just do domestic violence trainings at my church. And I'll just, I had my other outlets. I had poetry readings. I had so many other things that I just did that.
Mm-hmm.
And I never felt like, I have lots of feelings, as you know, about lots of people that we worked with and lots of environments. And my thing was, after being exited, pushed out, fired from the Georgia Coalition, my first and only place that I've ever been fired from before or since, because I spoke out about something that I thought was wrong and was quickly ushered out. And that was a huge lesson for me, like, being fired and then the executive director, just the ugliness of the field. Executive director calling the board, telling them not to talk to me because she knew I was going to say what happened, So that was the first betrayal in the movement and the people that I was sticking up for choosing to be silent, and then they got promoted. And so that's when I was like, oh, this isn't like the big friendly party that I thought it was. Like, oh, wow, we're really not all in this together. And wow, the movement is really kind of racist. Like, and it's funny because when I first met Tanya, our old executive director from WOCN, when I first met her, Women of Color Network was going around to coalitions and doing trainings. She had just come out with her Endangered Advocate framework. And so she came to Atlanta and I sat with my executive director and my staff, and Tanya was like, so how are things? I'm saying, oh, I'm great. Like, I don't know about all these other people, but my executive director is fine, honey. Like, I ain't got no problems over here. I don't know what you're talking about.
None of that shit lives here.
I ain't got no problems up in this bitch. Yeah. Like,
I don't even know how many months later, maybe a year, I was gone.
Actually, after that, after that WLCN meeting.
Mm.
After that WLCN meeting, shit started to bubble up. But I mean, I didn't have any issues. Like, I started the Black Women's, you know, our WLCN caucus. I ran the caucus. Like, it was, and this is the thing I say about this work. Things are lit until it's not. Everything is great until it's not. You're the perfect employee until you're not. And usually for Black women, you're not when you start to like look around. At least in my case, I'd be like, well, why am I the only one using my laptop, my personal laptop for work? My white coworker, they're not bringing that. Why am I the only one driving and packing up stuff in my vehicle to go to conferences? My white coworker, they're not doing that. So when I started to like question.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
And be like, hey, why is this happening? Why is that happening? Why can my coworker have a headache and she doesn't have to come to work for 3 days, but if I have a headache, I just started to like really connect the dots and be vocal because we're a family.
Mm-hmm.
We're a family, right? Mm-hmm. Then it's when the curtain and the veils and the masks came on. Like, you're Black. Mm-hmm. You don't get to do
what we do.
Mm. So when that reality hit, then I was like, oh, okay, so I have to do the work completely different. And I just like made the decision. And again, that was my second year. I was like, I got fired. And the California Coalition reached out to me. You know, Tara was working there at the time, Tara Shabazz, Tara Peterson. And she was like, girl, we got 5 positions. You can audition for whichever one you want. And so... But I took 2 years out of the movement because I was like, this is not healthy. The people aren't healthy. Like, if I'm going to get back into it, I really have to take my healing and wellness seriously. And so then went to California, and that's really when everything changed. Like, when I left Atlanta, that's when everything changed because there was no more pretense. There was no more any of that. So I was like, I'm always going to put myself first. I was like, unless it's called Flowers Inc., I don't care what happens. I don't care. I'm not speaking up anymore. If people ask me how things are, I'm just going to be like, everything is fine. And just focus on my own stuff.
What are you doing?
I worked for Habitat Humanity. Where I got to put a lot of my new ways of being into practice. So when they were doing shit that was foul and they wanted to have a big meeting and they wanted to have the board come in and do listening sessions. And they were like, how are things? Everything's great. I just got here. Everything. I just put everything into practice. Like, and I just built my outside life. You know, I just like was writing my book and just like, minding my business and letting work be work.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that is part of the trickery. And I've talked to so many young Black advocates about this as well. You know, when you first come into the work, you think you're coming into family. You think you're coming into community. You think everybody's on the same page. You think we all want the same thing. We recognize we may come at it different ways, but we think we all want the same thing. And that's the first big lie, is that we don't all want the same thing. And when you wake up to that reality, that not only do we not all want the same thing, but what we want is determined by color or lack thereof, by race. And you're the one who gets the less.
Yeah,
it's heartbreaking because you think you're in the sisterhood. You think, oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And meanwhile, you know, we're out. I mean, I can't, you know, I don't march anymore, but, you know, so many times marching at the Capitol, DC Capitol, Georgia Capitol, you know, there was not a protest that I wasn't at. And then I was like, why am I on the front lines? And my colleagues are all like at home, married, having kids, like something's not right here. I think I made a misstep. Mm-hmm. I'm doing too much.
How did you be? Oh, that's too much.
I'm doing too much. I'm like, I'm doing too much.
Okay. Yes. Yes.
Working too hard.
Yeah. That should be the tagline for the field. Domestic violence or gender-based violence. We do too much.
We do too much. I mean, you know, we, Georgia Coalition, they decide to redo the office. They decided to like renovate the office. We're moving furniture. You know, I always said if people in the DV movement, if we ever quit our jobs, we could be moving companies so easily. The way we pack up offices and trucks and, I mean, we did too much. Because we loved, at least for me and the people that I was around at the time, we loved the work. So there wasn't anything that we were not willing to do for the work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think I love the, I don't think I ever loved the work, but I always loved the possibilities. I think what I was in love with, infatuated, are the possibilities. And every day I wake up believing that today is a day that one of those possibilities, you know, would manifest. That would get up, that we get a little bit closer to manifesting those possibilities.
Yeah.
The dream kept me with the rose colored glasses on.
I mean, I think I did believe that. I still do. I mean, when I talk to people, like I was at an event in Massachusetts last weekend. I was the lead witch in residence for my friend's ceremony. And when I showed up to the ceremony, there was a young white woman registering people. And she was like, "Do you remember me?" And I was like, "No." And she was like, "You gave me a reading like 6 years ago, and you said to me, oh, I think you could probably read tarot." And she was like, "And I've been doing it ever since, and my life was totally different." And so I think I've heard that so many times in our in the DV world as well, that I know that I did things that made an impact. It may not have been the impact that I would have wanted, but I know I made an impact.
Yeah. You know. Yeah, when I think back over the connections that I made with people, that's absolutely where the impact was made. You know, I could write another book about how, you know, relationships were formed in 60 seconds, in just a minute, on the elevator. You said you heard some. There was an exchange that was transformational, that brought me, that gave peace, that gave, you know, the dreams of possibilities, the strength to go on, you know, and on the elevator, walking down the stairs, going. So much transformation happened in our lives. Just engaging, being present with one another.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that was definitely another reason that I got up every day.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember questioning when I sensed that spirit was saying, "Okay, it's time to stop doing this congregational. This is, it's cute, but it's too small." I need to take you out to a bigger platform. And I was like, what is that? And the times when I would doubt that change, that next phase of call of ministry. And then I would see somebody, or somebody would call me, text me, email me, and say, "You remember whatever." And you did this thing. And people that I don't even remember, I hate, you know, four strokes later, I just can't remember everybody, but people coming up to me and saying, do you remember me? Because you did this profound thing, or you said this profound thing that changed my life. Like,
exactly. Exactly. That type of thing is just, it's not worth it for me.
Yeah. Yeah. That was the best of all of it. I think that all that we endured, I think those exchanges of human connection and inspiring one another, seeing one another, being with is where the real work happened. Yeah.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So tell me how you, because on my end, it was always just like surprises. Tell me how you began to just start doing other stuff along with your work. All of a sudden, Zoe's finishing a book. She's finished a book. Now it's a play. I'm like, how does she have time to do it? Like, and we're working. When we're doing too much, we're doing too much. How does she have time to actually write a
play? I don't know. And a movie.
Yep. Then I remember when you did the movie.
I don't know. I just had so much fire and so many things to say and so many. I mean, maybe it was moving to New York. So trajectory for folks that are listening. So I started out at the Georgia Coalition, was pushed out of there, went to the California Partnership to End Domestic Violence, left there willingly, went to the Florida Coalition, left there willingly. Quick little story, got quite ill. I got diagnosed with fibroids while I was at the Florida Coalition. And I took the full 3 or 4 months off of work. And as I was recuperating at that point, I started the work in 2000. So it was 2010. So I'm 10 years in. And all I had done was work. And here I am now, fibroids, I don't know, 30 pounds overweight, probably. Working 7 to 7, because the Florida Coalition was like that. It was, you know, just like a grind you up and spew you out kind of environment. And so now here I am. I have fibroids and people want to give me a hysterectomy. And I had to like fight to keep my uterus in Florida with all these doctors who all they want to do is, you know, like sterilize, you know, Black women. And as I was healing, I just started running the past 10 years through, you know, the recesses of my mind. And I was like, 10 years are gone. Not married, no children, like not in the best health. And health had never been an issue for me. And I was like, I wonder why that is. Mm-hmm. And it was like, ding, 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 ding. It's the work.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, okay, well, I need to go back to my art. So I quit that job. I moved to New York City and I started working on my play. And I worked on my play. I had savings because there's nothing to do in Tallahassee. So there's nothing to spend money on. So I had savings. And sorry, folks who live in Tallahassee, if you're listening.
But you know,
that was my experience. I mean, it wasn't anything you do. So, except go to Panama City, Florida. So I had money in the bank, so I could just like take a year and a half off and write. And that's what I did. I worked on my play and then started working at the Joyful Heart Foundation full time. And then, I wasn't working at WOCN yet, but I was now way more into my healing work. It was like, now healing is like number one. But I'm still working at Joyful Heart. Then I went to the Women of Color Network Call to Action. I had contracted with WOCN to do a couple of healing workshops. And that was great. And then I did several retreats at the Joyful Harp. And we were still workshopping the play at that time. So I already was like getting practice of like doing a full-time job and like doing this other thing. And I just moved into New York. I just had a fire, you know? I was so excited about everything. Certainly when 45 got put into office, that lit a real fire under me, because I was like, you know what? We could die tomorrow. I mean, and I'm not even exaggerating. I'm not being funny. Like, it was like, whoa, shit's really bad. And I need to just do every single thing that I want to do, because I am not promised tomorrow. And so that's just how I did everything. I just didn't think about it. I had the energy. It was fun. And so I just did everything. I just did every single thing that I wanted to do. And that was it. And it wasn't hard.
Mm. So tell me, when and how did the shift happen from focusing on healing yourself, recognizing that you needed healing, that the work,
yeah,
the city of the work was solely trying to kill you, and you wanted, and you then began to, or desire to do that same type of healing for others in the movement. How did that happen?
The healing took over because the healing was more fun.
Mm.
It just got to the point where DV was not fun. I felt like where I wanted to go with the work, people were not interested in going. The conversations that I wanted to have, people were not interested in having. I just started seeing things differently. I just wanted to do my own thing. And I had my own beliefs about how the work should be done. And I knew that the work was not sustainable because I was very healthy. And then all of a sudden I'm like having these things. And mind you, and I had already had that awakening in 2001. So I just was like, the movement, folks are ill. Folks are unwell. Folks are unwell in this movement. And I know this work. I know this movement. I know the language. I know how people think. I've been through it all. I've seen a lot. It's been a decade. And I feel like I speak their language. I am them. They are me. And I was like, I'm the best person to do this work.
Mm-hmm.
It was just that simple. I get it. I get the pressure. I got it. I understood it. I am a survivor. Like, I understand this work. And I also felt like I had an idea of how we could be better. Mm-hmm. But folks ain't gonna be better. And if they did want to be better, like, I'll never forget, I did this mini retreat at a shelter, and this woman came up to me and she said, I hear you talking about healing, and I can tell that it works for you, but I don't feel like it's accessible to me.
Mm.
And that was a new reality, because I had to realize that just because healing is second nature to me,
mm-hmm,
that doesn't mean it's really second nature to other people.
Right.
That's what I didn't get at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember when I was very young in ministry, and I thought that all the things that I was teaching women they could be and have and deserve, I thought was for them, but was not for me. I'm for years, or probably the first 7 years of ministry, I thought that. I thought that all those wonderful things that I knew could happen was available. I thought it was available and would happen with the people that I was serving. But not available to me. And so I get that, you know, how the sister or the woman could say, I see that works for you, but I don't think that's for me. Whatever that is, has been embedded so long. Yeah, it takes more than, going to a workshop to unearth that, to deconstruct
right.
and dethrone it. It takes
right.
a lot of time.
Right. And I have been in this, one of my students calls it a lifestyle, which I think was so interesting. I've had this lifestyle since I was 23 years old. So at that point, I was back in Connecticut, so I was probably 40 something. So I've been living spirituality, ideologies for by then 20 years. So for me, it's like second nature, but it was like, oh, of course it doesn't feel accessible.
Right.
Because even with all of the modalities that I had, I still had so much healing to do. So I could see how somebody who was like just hearing these things for the first time, how they would be like, well, I don't think that's possible for me. Well, I could see that. I just never had that. I just always thought everything was accessible to me. So there's also that.
Yeah, that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, I came to the planet with that and was shocked when people are like, no, everything is not accessible to you. that was shocking. Like, what do you mean? I'm Zoe Flowers. Everything should be accessible to me.
I got a memo here that says everything's going
to
be accessible.
Yeah. I mean, agreement when I came down here that everything was going to be accessible to me. Now here I am. And
right. And you're telling me that's not.
Y'all try to act like, yeah, it's not. Like, what's wrong with y'all?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
I used the word on the title for this podcast. I talked about the word evolutionary and revolutionary. But that's just how I see your life from the outside, But just from this call, just from this conversation, I don't know so much that it was evolutionary as much as it always was. You just began to shift time, prioritize time, space, energy towards those more important things like art and healing. But I still see it as revolutionary, and not revolutionary in as the, some people do it and some people don't. Some people can, some people can't. But that it requires that kind of effort and commitment, like revolutionary work does. It requires that you commit your whole being to it. And
yeah.
And I just, I put those words there, but I just want to hear from you, do you see your life and your movement, the journey of your life as evolutionary or revolutionary?
I think maybe revolutionary to other people.
Mm-hmm.
They might think it's revolutionary, mm-hmm. but for me, I'm just doing what I came here to do mm-hmm. and be who I came here to be. And I always have. And I just took people some time to catch up.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's one thing I had to learn. I just came here to just like, I just came here to kick it. You know what I'm saying? Like, I like to have fun. I just came here to kick it, have a good time, listen to some good music, eat good food. I just want to have a good time. And then I got in this relationship and it was like, oh my God, this is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, people get a, even though I had seen it growing up, it was like, when I had the chance, it was like, I do want to do something about this, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it was not, again, my goal. But if I look at it, somehow I had to do the DV work for all that time because I had to be around people like me, even though we weren't like 100% right. We were alike enough. We were like spirited. And I had to have that supervisor who wound up firing me. But I had to have her be the first person to say, like, you're more than this thing that you applied for. And here's a platform, right? And so many women in this work have given me a platform. And so I needed that. I needed that support. I needed that validation so that I could be like, you know what? Maybe I can write a play. Maybe I can write a book. Like, I needed the movement to like build me up, really, to build up my confidence so that then I could be my full self. Mm-hmm. You know, by the time I got to Women of Color Network, like I said, I was like, I'm not going to say anything to anybody. I'm just going to be quiet. I don't care what happens in these organizations. But Women of Color Network was a safe place to do that. So then I could like, ooh, take the armor off and be like, yeah, I'm doing this healing thing. And then Tanya will be like, great, you're doing it. Oh, you know, Tanya, oh, you're doing a healing thing? Well, guess what? You're in charge of the healing. Right? Write a grant for it. Right? So it was platform and it was trust, you know, people trusting that I could get the work done, that I could do the work, so that when it was time for me to jump off and do my own thing, I just had all of these years of succeeding. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't scary. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and I think that's an evolution. Mm-hmm. I think it was evolutionary. Because while I am very similar, I am the same kind of, you said I'm always the same. Yeah. Yeah. But the work also, I evolved a lot because of my time in the movement. Mm-hmm. How I communicate, like, I evolved a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And certainly, the more you gave time and energy to the creative and healing work, the artistic and healing work, you evolved spiritually.
100%. And then here I am, I don't know, 16 years into the work, however long, living in New York City, and now I'm in plays. And now I'm shooting a movie on my block. So it's like I wound up there anyway, which was so crazy. Like I wound up there anyway. Whereas for so long, I thought, oh, the violence detracted me. I thought that the violence got me off track. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But no, it actually gave me everything I needed so that by the time I could come back around to the acting or writing a book, now I have an audience. Now I have people that are like, oh, I'm gonna buy her book. I saw her speak. Oh, right. So it's just crazy. It just all circular. Revolution, 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 revolving. Mm. Mm-hmm. I got there anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is wild.
To a book my daughter says that I have to read. I have to read with her. It's called Spirit Comes from Water. And the sister talks about her background. Her people are Nigerian and Benin. And so the Yoruba traditions, she's well integrated into that. But I'm not sure because I'm not that deep into the book yet. But I think one of her close friends ended up being close friends with a Native American who similar spiritual beliefs and practices to what she learned from her parents and grandparents. And so their relationship ends up weaving this beautiful spiritual practice between the two of them and creating this wonderful spiritual growth. And at least that sounds like where the book is going. Again, I think I'm only in chapter 3. But anyway, I said all that to say, she talks about how we, before we manifested in this physical form here, that we had already made a commitment, so to speak, as to who we would be and what we would do. And then, but then we're surprised when we get here because we're in this body, which we didn't have.
Yeah.
And we're in this society. And then there's all these things there are blockages and limitations and all these things that try to deter you from and make you forget.
Yeah. 100%.
Yeah. The commitment that you made.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I was just reading that over this week, and I was, you know, realizing, like you were saying earlier, that so much of my life, so much of what I did, which seemed like I was going wiggly waggly, but was all in preparation for me to get here. To do the things, to be who I am today, and to do the things that I'm doing today. And so I said, I just brought all that together to say to listeners that, you know, it may seem like at times that you're so far away from your dreams and passions, and it may seem like there are forces more powerful than you that are blocking you from who you are and what you're here to do. But I want to say that all that is a lie. That you will be who you are and you will do what you are here to do if and when you allow yourself to be and do it.
Exactly.
If there's nothing and nobody that's stopping you. If you make the decision and make the commitment and stay with it. It doesn't say that it's going to be easy. Certainly our lives haven't been easy thus far. But here we are being exactly who we should be and doing exactly what we've always wanted to do. So it's doable. It's livable. It's livable.
It is.
So let me ask this closing question, almost closing.
I know there's so many other things to say.
Okay. So so for activists and advocates that are listening or that will be listening to this podcast, what would you like to tell them around, or share with them around how art and healing can change the way in which they do their work, the way they are in their work, and the way they produce their work?
Listeners, I'm making a face because I don't have the answer to that question. I don't know. Is everybody supposed to do that? I don't know if that's everybody's role. I don't know. If it's their role, if it's your role to do that, then you should find a way to do it. Gosh, you know, there's so many people that I've talked to over the years that actually don't want to be doing the social justice in quotation marks work. So I think that people should do what they came here to do. I think they should try to figure it out. But yeah, I truly don't have an answer to that. Gee whiz. I think if you have a spiritual leaning, if you have a spiritual leaning that you want to infuse into the work, I think we have to think about the current climate And so you kind of also have to learn how to code switch that. We say we meet people where they are in this work, but that has not actually always been my experience. I don't find that to be true. I think that's just one other thing that we say a lot. But if you want to infuse art and spirituality into it, you know, just kind of make sure that the people that you're working with are interested in that. I think, yeah, it's just my thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. It might not be everybody's thing.
Right. So I agree that, you know, it's not everyone's thing to necessarily do. Everyone is not artistic or have a leaning towards art or healing work
at all, or have any interest in it.
But I this could be some place where I have some narrow thinking. But but I think that art and spirituality, spiritual practices, whatever they are both healing modalities, are both healing techniques that I think, even if it's not what you have a propensity to call passion to do, you should be able to take in and experience, because that beauty and that wholeness is what I think enables a few of us to get through the hard work, the traumatic, toxic work of advocating and activist work that will enable us to live joyful, long lives, whatever long is.
I agree. I feel like if maybe perhaps we take the word spirituality out of it, because just again, the language, people are so traumatized that even just saying spirituality can turn people off.
Yeah.
So, but I do like that you said wholeness. And so if people want to bring some sort of wholeness into their life, then maybe it's being in nature, just very easy things like that. Encouraging the people you work with, the survivors or whoever that you're working with, to spend time in nature. If you do, even if you don't think you're an artist, you know, find something artistic to do. I think art can be cooking. It doesn't have to be traditional. And so maybe it's like rethinking that word too, rethinking art, you know. And one of my friends, Amy Turek, was saying on our call on Saturday that she's hunting for beauty. She hunts for beautiful things in the world. And I love that. And so I would offer that too to people, to like hunt for the beauty where you can find it and see if you can incorporate that beauty into your work.
I think
and into your life.
I believe that we are creative beings, that creativity is the foundation of beauty.
Absolutely.
We all have potential to create beauty.
Absolutely.
In our lives. And that's closer to what I mean about spirituality. I mean, creating that beauty in your life, and sharing beauty, and even encouraging others to be creative and create that beauty in their own lives. To me, that's closer to what I think around spirituality. And I think that when we're doing work, especially the way in which Black women do the work, we give our all in all and some to it. Creativity, I think, is the first, probably the one of the first things that we give up. That natural ability to create beauty in our lives.
Yeah.
I would say maybe the first thing is to to recognize that it's all around.
Yeah, absolutely. To recognize that. And I think, too, a lot of, at least for me, I didn't, for a long time, I didn't see my art as like work because I wasn't getting paid for it. Mm-hmm. So I saw it as a hobby that took a lot of time and I spent a lot of money making it. Mm-hmm. So there's that too. Like people could be doing something right now, but they're not seeing themselves as art and they're not seeing it as them being creative too. So mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
I remember for years, I always said, oh, I don't have a creative bone in my body.
Mm-hmm.
And then people started showing me where different things are. This is creative. This you just mm-hmm. created this thing. What do you mean you don't have a creative?
And yeah.
I was meshing that with artistic. I was thinking of that as artistic. I don't have an artistic bone in my body. But
right.
Even then, people began to show me, what do you mean? This is art. Look how you framed this and laid this out so beautiful,
absolutely.
Beautifully for people to experience this wonderful experience. If that's not art, I don't know what that is. And so
absolutely.
Sometimes, you know, it's just the language, the boxes of language
exactly.
That where our minds are in that stops us from seeing the beauty and brilliance of who we are and what we possess and what we create. Exactly.
Yeah. And if you're working in an organization where you feel like there's no room for that, then try to carve out some time outside of work to do that as much as you can until you get into a position maybe where you can be in that role, you know, 80% of the time.
Okay. So, you ready to talk about your new podcast?
Yeah, let's do it.
Come to the Break with Zoe Flowers. Mm-hmm. Would you say the podcast is an expression of all those things? Artistry, healing, spirituality, all those things. Would you say it's a compilation of all of that, or do you see it as expression of one particular part of your journey?
It's definitely an expression of everything, because it's actually, the podcast is just one aspect of a larger project.
Mm-hmm.
So the podcast is the first iteration of this conversation around grief. But again, it is just one part of a very large podcast, a larger project that will be on the way over the next couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Excellent.
Yeah.
You're not going to give any hints of what we should be looking forward to?
No.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But it is definitely this. And I was talking with someone this morning about that this podcast, it just makes so much sense. Like, coming from the domestic violence world to now being in this grief conversation, it's just like such a logical place for me to have landed
mm-hmm.
into this conversation. So yeah. So you want me to talk about how it came about, or
what do you want to talk about?
2020, I moved in with my mom in February of 2020. So also we've kind of talked around the healing work, but the actual healing work that I do is I'm a Reiki master, I'm a Tarot reader and teacher, and I do rituals and make spiritual baths and do all those things. So, and also channel. So I had gotten the sense that COVID was going to be bad in 2020. So I moved in with my mom and right before the international thing was shut down. So February 2020, we all know what was happening there. So I moved in with my mom. I thought it was just going to be a couple of months, and wound up being there for 4 years. 2024. Yeah, 4 years. So during that time, I started to see changes in my mother, in her health. And so she was diagnosed with dementia in the summer of 2023. And then In March of last year, she was diagnosed with, at that point, they thought it was cancer in one part of her body, like around her bladder. And then come to find out it had spread. And so she wound up passing that same July. So, and we always had a very turbulent relationship. So living with her for 4 years was very challenging. And then having to, not having to, choosing to caretake for my mom, even though it was very, very difficult. And then her passing was a huge event. And so, and then of course we had the election that November. So it was kind of like mom passed in July, buried her in early August. I inherited the house, you know, I had already started renovating it. So I was like just getting the house to kind of where I wanted it to be and working on my healing. And then this election happened in November. And I was like, oof, I don't think I can heal in the United States. I don't think I can like be in this house. Like, I just don't think I can be here. So I basically ran away from home and came here to Montreal in January of this year in the dead of winter. And so where I only knew two people and don't speak French. And I moved to a French province. And so it was really hard. It was really, really hard. Many days just snowed in tears. And then in March, 2 days after my mom's birthday, I just picked up my phone and started talking into my phone about what I was feeling and posted it to a podcast platform. And people really seemed to like it and it seemed to resonate with people. And so I really wanted to have this conversation about grief and the way we don't really talk about grief in the West. And I wanted to also connect the dots to all the griefs that we experience in life, you know? But I didn't want it to just be me. So then I had other people on. Elise was on. So I wanted to talk to other caretakers. I wanted to talk with survivors. I wanted to talk with people I knew about their experiences about grief. And so, it's been really, really gratifying to have this conversation and to hear people's stories. And it feels very much, again, in line with the domestic violence work, because when I wrote my book about domestic violence, it was kind of the same way, interviewing people and then putting it into a book. And so it's super, super familiar, but different territory, because now I'm looking at how do people grieve in other countries? Mm. And how did we get to a place where we feel like we don't, like one person I interviewed, he didn't feel like he was entitled to grieve because of the relationship he had. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious about like, how did we get here? Why are we so afraid of conversations around death and things like that? That's Come to the Brink. And it's called Come to the Brink because I'm inviting people to come to the brink with me, because so many of us are on the brink anyway. So it's like, join me. Join me on the brink. Let's all be on the brink together.
I love it. I remember when I was on the podcast to talk about self-love, and I like to separate, because I think self-care and self-love is two different things. And so tell me, at this stage of your life, living in two countries, starting your podcast and whatever else is being birthed from that, how are you taking care of yourself and how are you loving yourself?
I leaving was the great step in loving myself. Clearly my spiritual work is me loving myself, like tending to my ancestor altars or tending to the other altars I have around here. So I felt like I was living too much in the work part of my astrological makeup. And so I decided to lean into the Venus part of my astrological makeup. And so just by working with Venus alone, that has been, because Venus is all about love, relationships. So pink today, pink hair, lavender hair, just constantly reminding me of like love, spraying myself with rose water, taking spiritual baths, allowing myself to sleep late, you know, because my life is not as busy. So coming here, I'm still meeting people. Things are like popping, but I have a lot of free time. And so there's times when I'm like, oh, you should be doing something. Oh, you should be, And it's like, no, I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to look at YouTube videos. That's what I was doing before you called. That's what I'm going to do when we get off the podcast. That's how I'm loving myself. Riding bikes. Like, I be riding bikes around my neighborhood now. Like, taking walks and actually, like, for Montreal, it's just, like, so beautiful. And so I'm walking and like, I'll just stop and I'll just look at a flower. Like I'm literally like stopping not to just smell the roses, but like to look at them intently and just like take in the beauty. There's so many ways that I'm loving myself now. So many, you know, that I'm like, wow, girl, you're really doing it. You know, you're really, really doing it. So yeah. Those are just some of the things. Spending time with family and friends. Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Thank you, Zoe.
And so as we wind this up, anything else that you want to share?
But yeah, come to the Brink with me. Zoe Flowers airs every Tuesday at 7:11 a.m. I think we're probably going to take a break. For a while, I think I'm probably going to take a break and, we'll see, but there's lots of episodes that you can see on all podcast platforms. Check me out on Instagram. I'm on there quite often doing readings and things like that. And, I think, yeah, that's, oh yeah, I have books. I have two other books that, that you can buy. One is From Ashes to Angels, Just a Journey Through Womanhood. So that is interviews that I did with domestic and sexual survivors. And then the second one is In Praise of the Witch. That is a book of poetry. So those are on my website, which is iamzoeflowers.com. So that's iamzoeflowers.com. So yeah, I think that's sufficient. And of course, if people want healing and wellness work, I'm available. Tarot readings and all of that stuff, but I'll make sure Elise has all that information.
Zoe, thank you so much for
thank you
the podcast today and telling your truths, your many truths, and being I don't want to say transparent, I'm gonna say just being you, because that's who you've always been.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I receive that. Thank you so much.
Yeah. And so it can be in a recording for eternity, that I love you and adore you. And I'm so grateful to have had years of being across the work table with you. You will never know how much you inspired my life and encouraged me. And it's so much. It's so much. It's,
thank you.
You know that thing of what would so-and-so do? It's a constant in my brain. I have a drawer in my brain that says, what would Zoe do? That I quite frequently as I travel my journey to be who I am and to do the things that I know that I'm here to do. I very often pull out that drawer.
If you want to be on the podcast, if you want to share your story, your wisdom, your strategies for change, please email me at blackwomentalkingback@gmail.com. We're lining up panelists all the time. We're going to do some panelists, and we're going to do a lot of individual interviews. So there are a lot of sisters that have written books this last couple of years. I want to interview sisters who are writing their stories, who are telling their stories in book form, those who are doing new research and policy work, just our gamut, the full gamut. So if you're interested in being on the podcast, please email me and let me know. Once again, I love you all. I love you, every single one of you. I love you. Until the next time, don't forget to follow us.